Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Inside Lacrosse Division One podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Dan Flynn. And Dan, last week we were overlooking your fireplace in your house, and today I am overlooking Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina. Our schedule's a little bit all over the place, huh?
Yeah, they are. But you had a business trip you had to make, and we have to take care of our loyal listeners. So let's, I know we're short on time, let's get right into it.
Yeah, man. So, yeah, we'll save the nonsense for next week. But that's a good thing because it was a crazy week of lacrosse action. I don't remember another year that featured an early season weekend with as many upsets as we saw this past weekend. You know, just kind of jumping right in out of the chute. Was there anything that stood out to you?
Yeah, there were quite a few games, actually. You know, there were some big games matching up top teams that, for the most part, did not disappoint at all. And then there was Hofstra going down to Chapel Hill and really taking the Tar Heels behind the woodshed.
So that's a game that I definitely want to talk about, but you're right, there were some big matchups. Let's start at the top of the charts, and, you know, the charts are also something that I want to talk about. But I was at the Ridley Athletic Complex with almost 5,000 other folks, and that I wrote nearly 5,000 a couple times because I think that there was far more than 5,000 fans. The venue seats 6,000. I know that 4,868 number was the number of tickets scanned. I don't know if there's like a hole in the fence or what, but it definitely felt like more than 5,000 folks there. And one point about this game, so if it had been inverted, the halves had been inverted so that the first half was the second half, it would have been so awesome because the way that the game unfolded, it was very clear that Loyola wanted to play a frenetic style, up and down, unscripted, whereas Johns Hopkins wanted to play a more staid, by the book, scripted style of game, 6-on-6 offense, 6-on-6 defense. The Greyhounds got what they wanted in the first half, and the Blue Jays got what they wanted in the second half. And the result was, you know, the home team built a nice lead, took it into halftime, lost the second half, but was able to hold on and win the game 9-8. And, you know, I think that now with two top 10 at the time wins under their belt, you got to start to wonder whether or not this is Shades of Greyhounds 2012 and 2014.
Well, it'd be hard to replicate their 2012 season for sure, but they're off to a fantastic start. They have two fantastic wins that are as good or better than anybody else has, and they're going to hold up too throughout the season. They have a couple more big out of conference games still to play, you know, one coming up in a few weeks against Duke. But they're sitting pretty with their 2-0 record, especially with their win against Hopkins this weekend.
So you reminded me of something via text message after this game. I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, so do you mind sharing with the audience what it was?
Yeah, I do believe we'll have to check the tape from last week, but you did predict a one-goal win for your Loyola Greyhounds, and I think you even predicted 9-8 would be the final score. So my hats are off to you. That was a great prediction, but that's why you are in the position where you are, Terry.
Well, it was
a leading voice in the sport.
If that were true, I would have remembered that if I were truly a leading voice, I would have remembered my prediction. But yeah, I mean, in that way, I will say that the game didn't necessarily deviate much from expectations. You know, I thought that if there was a surprise on the Loyola side, it was that the second midfield provided an impressive spark where the first midfield was a little bit more isolated in their plays. You know, Brian Sherlock had a really nice kind of bomb. Tyler Albrecht made one big play, but they weren't as like consistently and continuously dangerous as I would have expected in order for Loyola to win. And then the second point I want to make about the Greyhounds is that they're very flexible defensively. You know, I was impressed by the fact that sophomore Foster Huggins, who we shouted out last week, was on Ryan Brown much of the game, and not David Manning, who I predicted was going to be covering him. You know, that being said, I thought that, you know, the three close defensemen played very well as a unit, limited the danger that Shaq Stanwyck and Ryan Brown particularly caused. But the one point that I want to add is once again, Loyola looks very good off the ground. And I want to specifically point out, I believe he's a sophomore, defenseman, I think his name is Jack Kerrigan. He is excellent at picking up ground balls in traffic, particularly when his stick is completely vertical from the ground. And it's a really important and really unique skill to be able to pick up a ground ball in that type of situation, come away with it, get to safety, and then, in the Greyhounds' case, turn that into transition offense. But, Dan, I'm sure that you watched this game or followed this game with an eye towards the Blue Jays as a Johns Hopkins alum. Do you have any takeaways, and where do you fall on Coach Petromalo's spectrum of it's not time to panic, don't write us off yet, there's still a lot of lacrosse left to be played?
Well, I definitely agree with that. And Petro, it is the second game of the year. They got a win against Navy. They lost by one goal on the road to a big rival, and it's not even March 1st yet. So it's no reason to panic. Hopkins, you know, one of the things that we saw out of this is, you know, they have a fairly young team. You know, Shaq, Stanwyck, three assists, but no shots on goal. And then their first midfield, which really felt the effects of losing Joel Tinney and Connor Reed this week. You know, Quint Kessnick had a great write-up in during his top 20 this morning where he talked about them being 2-for-18. That's Sapinski, Catone, Crawley midfield. And they really need to get more out of there. They got to give Ryan Brown some more help.
I do think that Drew Sapinski growing up fast is something that we kind of predicted it was going to happen, and it kind of needs to happen in order for the Blue Jays to, you know, I don't know what the word is. I wouldn't say meet their potential because, you know, it's very difficult to predict what their potential is at this point. But in order for the Blue Jays to hit the expectations, be that quarterfinal, Final Four level team that their fans rightly expected them to be coming to this season. Well, let's move on. Let's head south. Jeff Shannon was down in Atlanta for the Cobb County Classic, and there were two great games. It's funny. I mean, these were face-off classic level matchups. First, yeah. Notre Dame, Georgetown, but then hallmarking, highlighting the marquee, the veranda, was Denver coming away with a 14-12 win over Duke. And in that way, it feels similar to the game last year. Like, you know, I don't remember if I wrote this, I don't remember if we spoke about it on the podcast, but I was kind of the opinion that there was almost no result to this game that was going to surprise me or make me feel super strong one way or the other about each team's prospects going forward from a negative end. I mean, from a positive end, I think they're both two of the top three or four teams in college lacrosse. And I think that the game bore out that they were able to go toe-to-toe. You know, this was a game that if you looked at the score at periodic times throughout the contest, you know, was unfolding in a number of different ways. And I was impressed by both teams' ability to battle back from sustained runs. There were larger margins than the two-goal final margin. But the fact that the game never got out of hand either way impressed me.
Yeah, it was a magnificent game, a game of a lot of mini runs. Denver had two three-goal runs and then a couple three other times when they scored back-to-back goals. On the other side, Duke had two three-goal runs and scored back-to-back two other occasions. So it was a back-and-forth game a lot, very close. It was great for fans. I wish more people could have seen it. I think there were about 3,000 people on the official attendance for the day down in Kennesaw, and about 3,000 people downloaded the stream too. So a game like this, and along with the Notre Dame Georgetown game, I just wish more people could have seen it.
Yeah. So a couple things about this, and I was able to, I had the web stream up, but you know, I was watching at least for the first half Loyola Hopkins. And in the second half, I was, you know, writing a post game story and going to the press conference and stuff like that. But both from my impressions based on what I was able to watch live, watching the highlights, looking at the box score, you know, I spoke about it last week. I don't think it's their Achilles heel. I don't think it's their death knell, but you know, you can't help but notice that Deemer Class and Miles Jones combined for 7 of Duke's 12 goals. You know, it does feel like they're going to need to find some scoring pop elsewhere, and that includes the fact that Miles Jones chipped in 2 assists. So, you know, the playmaking coming from 2 senior midfielders, like, it's just, it's not a surprise that it's their asset or their strength early, and it's not going to be surprising if and when new scorers do emerge. But it just is very clear that, you know, they're going to need a little bit more out of their known quantities in terms of, you know, a guy like Case Mathias, who had a 1-goal, 3-assist game, did his part, you know, but you're going to need a little bit more than 2 goals out of Jack Bruckner and Justin Guterding in order to be a national championship level team. And then, you know, once again, the second midfield not on the stat sheet as well. I really like this Blue Devil team. But I think that that's kind of, you know, you put up 12 goals on Denver, you can be really proud of yourself, but you take a closer look and see how limited or how concentrated that offensive output was, and you say, all right, you know, is this sustainable long term? Was there anything from a Denver perspective? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I agree with you about, you know, looking for alternatives for Duke's offense. But at the same time, when you have two first-team All-American midfielders who are seniors, they should be taking a majority of your shots. And they took 14 of Duke's 30 shots. So it's about right. And, you know, and they contributed, you know, 9 points between the two of them. So that's about right. Yes, they will need to get more balanced scoring to be a national championship-level team. But I think at this point in the season, those guys are getting, they're not hogging the ball, but they are taking the shots that they probably should be taking.
Right.
From Denver's side, you know, after the first quarter, Trevor Baptiste really dominated on faceoffs. I think he won 17 of the last 25. And that's going to be, you know, when you have possession like that, that's going to help them all season long.
And that
was something you can just hang your hat on.
I'm with you. And it was actually kind of surprising. Not surprising, but it was like, because Kyle Rowe is really good. I don't know, man. You just get used to seeing like 19 to 22 days for Trevor Baptiste. And so, you know, when he's getting played even, which, you know, was one of the things that I was able to notice in what I was able to watch in the first half, it is surprising, even if he's going against another top flight opponent. So, I think the thing for me, you know, obviously we talked about how Connor Cannizzaro had been a little bit quiet prior to this Duke game in Denver's early outings. So that was, you know, that was significant. But the thing that stands out to me when you look at their scoreline, Colton Jackson, 2 goals. Austin French, 1 goal. Max Planning, 1 goal. Connor Donahue, 1 goal. Like, these are not guys necessarily that you expected to be their goal scorers. So, you know, in the same way that we were talking about Duke's depth of scoring, we were talking about Denver last week as well. And I think that maybe in this game, you know, one of the key differences was that the Pios got a little bit more in that depth of scoring in you know, their second game of the season.
Yeah, they received points from 11 different guys. And that's impressive.
Yeah. So,
moving on, Terry.
Right?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Go ahead.
I mean, you know, from your takeaway, was the best team in the country in Atlanta?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I don't know which one it's going to be in the end, but I think that there were three of the strong candidates, you know, definitely down there. So it's hard to say after such a short amount of time and only seeing Notre Dame one time, but the best teams were probably in Atlanta.
Got it. Okay. Well, there is one guy that we could ask about this, and I want to shout him out right now. So we have our weekly feature, right, about the takeaway from a broadcast.
Yeah.
And
the broadcast, webcast, observation of the week.
Exactly.
Who's your guy this week?
So Marcus Holman, it's not a surprise that he's good at this. He's got good energy. He's always got good observations. He served as the color analyst for the web stream coming out of the mm-hmm. Connie Classic. And I think that you gotta give him a nod for the Shooter McGavin reference. I believe it was tip tip tippity around the crease. And once again, not surprised that that he would channel Billy Madison. Not a week goes by, it feels like, that Marcus isn't retweeting a Shooter McGavin Twitter account. But I was just I was pleased and impressed that he stayed true to his roots and he was able to work that into the stream.
What about you? What was your take on the Notre Dame Georgetown game?
So I think that the foremost take is Sergio Perkovic is awesome. We all knew he was awesome.
Yes,
but up to this point, he hasn't been like a regular season star. You know, he's really been like kind of a 20-goal-a-game season guy who's always capable of a huge outburst, and it's typically come in the ACC tournament or in the national championship tournament or in the national semifinal or national championship game. But 4 goals in an early season contest against a good defense. I think Georgetown's going to prove to be a good defense. You know, it's hard to overlook that. It's hard to get past that. The second strongest takeaway, and I, you know, I think Georgetown is firmly in that meaty, you know, in the rankings 15 to 20 team. And I thought that they comported themselves well against the consensus number one team in the country after, you know, being on their heels a little bit early. I don't know, you know, to what degree they played them late, but it seemed like the game was pretty much even from midway through the second quarter on.
They'll have a big game this week. We'll get to that in a little bit about the Hoyas. But moving north, Syracuse plays Albany, battle of top 20 teams. What's your takeaways from that?
Yeah, so, you know, it was interesting. You made the comment, I believe, Trevor Baptiste finished 17 and 25, and that's what Ben Williams was. So, you know, in this way, it's very reminiscent of what we've seen from Syracuse-Albany matchups in you know, previous years. I think that the reason that Albany has been able to get to 10, 11, 12 goals against Syracuse during the Thompson era was because of that offensive proficiency and exactly how good they are. I thought that the reason that they only got to 7 was because, you know, their possession disadvantage was just the same, but they weren't able to be more efficient in their 6-on-6 offense. I thought that, simply put, Ben Williams looked like an absolute animal. He finished 17 for 25, but he started 11 for 11. And during that point, it wasn't even a question. It didn't even look like he could be beaten. He is so athletic, and that might necessarily be the difference if you were to see a Trevor Baptiste, Ben Williams matchup. Like, I think Trevor Baptiste is probably a more technical faceoff specialist, but I think Ben Williams could lose the draw and still make life very difficult for Baptiste. That would be the part of the matchup that I would be most excited to watch. Syracuse, I really like their versatility of offensive weapons. And I think that it starts with Matt Lane's emergence. He scored 2 goals and had 2 assists. He's, you know, 6'4", 220 pounds, if not bigger. He looks like Sergio Perkovic. That's a shout out to Joe Sweeney, who texted me that last night. And I thought that I was impressed that Dylan Donahue didn't have to do everything in order for Syracuse to be dangerous offensively. There were a lot of guys like Sergio Salcido, like Tim Barber, who have been around the Orange offense. Derek DeJoe is another one who had a hell of a game for a long time. And by around, I mean, like, you know, kind of always on the cusp of being a regular, you know, regular second line midfielder, man on specialist, whatever, that emerged and put in good performances offensively. Thought Jordan Evans looked pretty good. I thought he was more assertive. Finished with 4 turnovers and 2 goals. So, you know, I think that's something that Jordan Evans haters are going to point to. And, you know, I think that that's okay. I'd rather at this point in the season, given the way his career has gone, be a guy who takes risks and tries to make plays, because he just hasn't made enough plays in his career to, you know, kind of shake the monkey off his back, as it were. And then the other end of the field, I thought Albany's going to be just fine. They're going to be in that top 10 discussion all year long, because even though, you know, they only put up 7 goals, it's still pretty impressive given how much of a possession disadvantage they were at. But the thing that stood out to me the most is they are aggressive, man. They're tough. They're physical defensively, and they are fast once they get the ball. Kyle McClancy is a people, you know, love that about his game. You know, there were a handful of other guys that were running upfield right alongside him. And I think that it means that Albany's identity is intact, and it means that they're going to be difficult for a lot of opponents that don't have the talent that Syracuse does. But maybe when it comes down to, and I spoke about it earlier, that offensive efficiency, that ability to get to 10, 11, 12 goals against Syracuse, it's not all a lack of Lyle Thompson. I thought Nick Mellon did a really, really nice job. I thought that, you know, you can kind of see why there's some excitement around the Syracuse defense going forward. He doesn't make it easy on ball carriers, particularly guys that are being lazy on the perimeter. So when you combine that with Brandon Mullins, who, you know, at this time last year was being talked about as the defensive player of the year, you have, you have a smaller, more agile defender versus a you know, bigger, more physical defender. It's a good like kind of component to have. And then aside from that, you know, I believe is it Jay McDermott or Bobby Tate? You know, the third defenseman is no slouch either. So I think Syracuse, they've got all the pieces. And coming away from that game, I wouldn't argue too strongly that they are not the best team in the country. So, you know, to the question about whether or not the best team was in Atlanta, I think Syracuse and Loyola, theoretically, more likely than not, are going to have something to say about it.
Yeah, Syracuse was definitely impressive, no doubt about it. I didn't mean to slight them. For Albany, Reardon makes 17 saves, which sounds great, but they were outshot 59-25. And so Syracuse doubled them up, more than doubled them up shooting the ball. So he's faced a constant barrage. Syracuse did look very impressive in that game, no doubt. Now, moving on to what you call – oh, do you have another point?
Well, I mean, I just – you know, to shout out Blaze Reardon, you know, I really like him. Yeah, I think he's going to be a goalie whose save percentage doesn't reflect how good he actually is. And, you know, making 17 saves, those big numbers are awesome because it's one of the things that catches people's eye and gets him some attention that he's not going to get because he's going to be, you know, a 54 to 56% guy more likely than not, you know, when he probably in a different system could very, you know, could probably be like a 60, 61, 62% guy.
Moving on to another game, which you called in the Epic Isle Game Day Sunday recap, you called this your upset of the week was Ohio State and UMass.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, you know, well, I called it that because Matt took the obvious choice. I'm going to say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so did I.
There are a couple of reasons. There are two very obvious reasons that it should not be that surprising. The first is because UMass plays their best when you least expect it. And the second is because Ohio State, you know, every year, but this year more than most, is going to be a team that improves over the course of the season. So, you know, it wasn't a stunner to me. I think the thing that was most stunning is that, you know, UMass got a lot of goals from guys whose names we've never heard of. Now, that was bound to happen. If they were going to be good, they were going to be good because they got offensive contributions from guys that we didn't hear of. But, you know, Buddy Carr didn't even, you know, have that great of a game in their first outing. They lost, and, you know, I made this point on the game day video. They beat Ohio State despite not having a great day facing off, despite not having a great day in the goal. So, you know, be under 50% in both those categories, put up an offensive explosion against, you know, if you were going to pick which unit between Ohio State's offense and defense was going to be the better one heading into the season, you would have picked their defense. You know, once again, tip of the hat to Coach Cannella. God, it's amazing. It's amazing how continuously they're able to do this. Like, whenever you think they're going to be bad because you don't know who their talent is, they don't have the known quantities, it's the definition of a good program, in my opinion. Like, they're not always the best team, but they're a good program because they routinely are better than what you think their talent dictates they should be as an outsider. And again, you know, that's also commenting on the obvious flaw of being an outsider trying to make expectations about talent, but it's what we do. It's what we're here for.
Hey, but before we jump to the Hofstra Carolina game, let's stick on the Minutemen for a minute and talk about your Twitter follow of the week. One of the most famous Minutemen of all time.
Yes. Great call. All right. So Mark Millen, National Lacrosse Hall of Famer, brought to my attention a tweet that I believe was an assistant coach at Grand Valley State University in a game against a D2 school in a part of the country that I would not know offhand. A bird picked, you know how like in women's lacrosse when they call timeout, you leave you go to the sideline. A bird came and picked up the stick and carried it like a good ways before eventually dropping it onto the field and flying away. I mean, is like the only response that I can come up to that. Like, first of all, how big does a bird have to be in order to pick up a lacrosse stick?
Big. And first of all, the video itself is like, bravo to the person who captured that, because just to have your phone out, to be ready to take that, unbelievable. I loved it. And then this bird's trying to build a nest, obviously, and just saying, okay, I'm going to start big. You know, forget about the twigs that I was picking up before. I'm going big time here.
You realize if she got it back to a tree, like, you're almost halfway there just with the pocket. Like, you lay eggs in the pocket, put a couple twigs in there, and you're done. Man, that is efficiency.
Yeah. It's a huge – oh, God. It was great. And shout out to Mark Millen, one of the great all-time players, certainly in the last 25 years. For pointing that out, and a great follow on Twitter at Mark Millen on Twitter.
Yes.
Now
we talked about Coach Cottle last week. You know, we're continuing our streak of picking out guys who don't shy away from sharing their opinions. Always the best guys on Twitter.
Yes, for sure. And anyone who knows Mark, a bold personality, and as you said, not afraid to say what's on his mind. Now, to go on to back to the game that that had a lot of people talking, the result that had a lot of people talking was Hofstra going down and upsetting Carolina, and Josh Byrne, his debut at the Division I level was incredibly impressive.
So, what, like, I mean, do you want to join the people, the rank of people who calls me an idiot for not ranking Hofstra in the top 20 this week? I mean, you're welcome to.
Top 20?
I'm not going to be upset. I'm going to defend myself.
No, I think there were some unknown quantities, obviously, of people. And what a debut for this guy.
Yeah. All right. So sticking with the game, and it's, you know, this was not streamed. So, you know, it's unfortunate to a degree. I think it happened in a vacuum. I still haven't seen highlights, so I don't know if those are out there yet. And if they are, I'm going to have to track them down. But, you know, there are a couple factors that I take into account, you know, immediately coming away from just kind of perusing the box score. So, you know, the first is Sam Lanier is a known quantity. He's been Hofstra's best player for a couple of seasons. You mentioned, obviously, he's paired with an unknown quantity, at least at the Division I level, a physical presence. It's clear that Hofstra has a good thing going offensively with those two. You know, aside from that, just their ground ball numbers were remarkable as well. So another factor in a similar game in the sense to UMass Ohio State, in the sense that it wasn't as if the you know, the specialty positions, the faceoff guy, the goalie, dominated in a way that, you know, it justified or it made it clear that, like, why the outcome would be what it was. You know, this, so saves were 11 for Hofstra, 10 for North Carolina. Faceoffs were 9 for Hofstra, 9 of 17, 8 of 17 for North Carolina. So those are even, right? Like, those two specialty positions played even. Turnovers were even as well. You know, it was the ground ball advantage that Hofstra came away with, coupled with an incredible offensive performance from two guys. And so here's my thing as it relates to, like, Hofstra's, what this says about Hofstra, who they are going forward. So the first is, I can draw a parallel line between what Carolina looked like against Hofstra and what I can imagine them looking like going forward as a result of this game, as to what we saw from Virginia against Loyola versus Virginia against Drexel. Which is, you know, you take it, Virginia was playing without two of their better, you know, two starting attackmen, but still just, according in the words of both Dom Starja and Brian Volker, like, just dominated possession. It sounds like dominated 50-50 balls. It sounds like Hofstra did something similar to North Carolina. And I think that every once in a while, it's similar to what happened with Loyola. Every once in a while, you don't have it. Now, whether it's a flaw of the team or a fatal flaw of the team versus just not bringing enough energy and focus that day depends on the team and it depends on the day. So that's kind of like my first thing. And all my entire point as it relates to who Hofstra is going forward is I just want to see it twice. If they do it again, they're going to have a win over Princeton and that will make them a top 10 team. But for me at this stage in the season, the possibility that that game was an anomaly or an outlier exists to the degree that I felt like they belong in that tier of team that includes Navy, Villanova, a couple of other good teams who this week had not deserved to be knocked out of the top 20, in my opinion. Marquette is another one. And so that's where, you know, if I could have put a tie for 18 with five teams, that would have been my choice. But as it relates to Hofstra, you know, I just want to see it one more time because this was a team that was 5-9 and had an RPI of number of 45 last season. And so it's hard for me to shake. I understand that this team is not the same as that team, but the foundation of this team returns from last year. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to just say, like, I just want to see it one more time.
Yeah, there were definitely some people shaking their head when the Cascade Maverick media poll came out today. People saw that North Carolina is still ranked a couple spots above Hofstra, even though they went down to Chapel Hill and won. For Carolina, Quint had some great points rewatching the Michigan game.
Yeah.
And looking at some of Michigan's defensive mishaps that led to easy North Carolina scores that may have led us all to believe that they were going to be fine without Sankey and Bitter. And maybe that's not the case, that Hofstra may have exposed some of their offensive issues that may continue throughout the season.
Well, right now they're a team without midfielders. Michael Tagliaferri and Timmy and Patrick Kelly were the three starting middies, and two of those guys are attacking. That's just – and not only that, the other thing that's odd about it is that they're as attacking Steve Pontrello as a converted midfielder. So, you know, I think from an offensive standpoint, they're still, kind of figuring out who they are. So I can understand Quinn's point. I think that, the thing that has been most surprising to me right now is that Shane Simpson only has two assists. He has not scored. He is, I think, what Chad Tutton was when he was at his best. You know, big, tall, lanky, good shooter, Canadian. And I think that after having a very injury-riddled sophomore season, people expected big things out of him as a junior, and we haven't seen it yet. I don't know what to make of them defensively yet because I wasn't able to see this Hofstra game. And even if I were, I would still give a little bit of benefit of the doubt to the fact that, it would have been very difficult to prepare for Byrne, a guy who had not played a Division I game yet. So, that's another reason why, kind of just want to see him do it one more time. Like, Princeton will have a week's worth of film on Hofstra to be able to prepare for.
Yeah, so let's talk about the games this coming week. There's some pretty good ones. That Hofstra, Princeton game you referenced a few times, will be telling for the Pride for sure. But looking at the Cascade Maverick calendar, the Carolina has a huge game coming up this Sunday at noon at Homewood Field.
Yeah, and I think that in the same way, Dom in his postgame story or postgame press conference after Drexel said, this is referring to Virginia. I don't often say, some games are bigger than others, but this one felt big to us. We were on our heels and needed a win. And, I wouldn't be stunned to hear Joe Bresci say something similar after the game on Sunday as it relates to how important this Johns Hopkins game is for them. I'm sure that there's, a little bit, maybe even more than a little bit of doubt in the locker room in Chapel Hill right now. But, that can be quickly rectified with a positive performance.
This is my watch of the week, the Carolina Hopkins game. Again, it'll be ESPNU starts their games this weekend. It's one of two games that they're doing. This will be Sunday at noon at Homewood Field. And as one of our international listeners, Terry Javi, suggested, do you have a matchup within the matchup of this Hopkins North Carolina game that fans should look for?
Yeah, well, so I think that in terms of what is the most likely kind of result, that's the wrong way of putting it. Where on the field is most likely to determine the outcome of the game, I think, might be a better way of putting it. That's kind of where, so I'm looking at Hawkins' offense versus Carolina's defense. We talked about who was going to cover Ryan Brown last week, and I think that that is an interesting question, but that is an expected question. You're going to see that every time. I'm really curious to see who Carolina decides to pull on Hopkins' first midfield. That is that dodging threat, particularly so this is what I noticed when John Crowley scored his two goals. Possession had gone on for a fair amount of time. Johns Hopkins had run a couple different plays for looks that didn't come to fruition, and then Crowley gets the ball and scores an unassisted goal, and he did it twice. And to me, right now, that is the guy that you need to put a long pole on in order to be able to slow down Johns Hopkins' playmaking from the midfield. That being said, he's not a dangerous feeder, so do you take some gambles with some other guys that might be a little bit more versatile in terms of their skill set? Now, I don't know. So that's one. And then I guess, you always kind of point to the faceoff X. And Craig Matteris did a really nice job, particularly early against Loyola, giving Johns Hopkins a possession advantage that they were not able to take advantage of for a number of different reasons, primarily sloppiness in their defensive end and not being able to clear the ball. So I would say that if I had a second matchup within the matchup to watch, it would be the faceoff X.
Well, I can't wait for that one. Another game ESPN's doing is UMBC at Ohio State, Friday at 5 p.m.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. It's in the horseshoe. You know, obviously it loses a little bit of its luster with both teams coming off of a loss. The Retrievers lost at home against the Richmond Spiders, and we already discussed Ohio State losing in Amherst. So a bounce back game that one team needs. It's Friday afternoon lacrosse. There's not a lot that's better than that. So I would highly recommend checking this one out. Certainly going to get a lot of fundamental play between these two coaching staffs.
You said that's in the horseshoe?
Yeah.
No, that surprises me a bit.
I think that early in the season, you risk tearing up the turf if you're at Jesse Owens.
Got it. But we'll be watching that here in the Inside Lacrosse headquarters at 5 o'clock on Saturday. Friday night, 5 o'clock, ESPNU. A few other really good top 20 matchups. Maryland at Yale. Yale's won early in the season last year, 10-6. Maryland got even and won the one that counted in the NCAAs. But you know what surprised me about the Maryland game is how High Point had a lead at halftime.
Yeah.
And then the Terps turned it on and more or less blew them out. It was 15-10 final, but they were behind at one point, 6-3 or something like that.
Yeah.
So that was surprising.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so you mentioned obviously the controversial NCAA tournament loss. Mike Kesey goal, did it cross the goal line, did it not? Terps fans go on to the Final Four and national championship game. So clearly, you know, there's a lot at stake here for Yale. And this was a win last year in the regular season that helped bolster them going forward, you know, helped them NCAA tournament time as well. So when you look at their schedule, Yale has been a team that's been able to rely on the Ivy League automatic qualifier in years past, but this is a big one as it relates to their at-large resume.
Yeah, number four Maryland at number seven Yale, 1 o'clock on Saturday. You'll probably be able to see that on Yale site and streaming it through there. Another game, actually, I'm kind of looking forward to. I want to see how this one turns out. Georgetown at Towson, noon stream on TowsonTigers.com. This Saturday at United Stadium.
I'm trying to decide whether or not to go to this one. You know, it was we discussed Georgetown's performance against Notre Dame. I was impressed by their, you know, mental toughness, ability to stick with it. Tossing out to a 2-0 start. You know, hard to take too much away from their pair of wins. They're coming off of a 9-5 victory over Mount St. Mary's, and they beat Mercer 11-2 in a game that we discussed last week that was moved because of weather. And I think that if there's anything you're going to take away from that, it's the fact that opponents are averaging 3.5 goals per game against Towson, and obviously that is a continuation of what was one of the country's best defenses last year. You know, but at the same time, not surprisingly, Georgetown showed a tremendous number of weapons. You know, even though they were limited to single digits against Notre Dame, you know, periodically watching that game over the course of you know, the first half and prior to the start of the Loyola Hopkins game, they just, you know, you could see a number of guys, ball carriers for Georgetown that were dangerous, that were able to get Notre Dame's defense moving. And I think that, you know, even if the goal total wasn't there, the seeds to what we're going to see as the Hoyas come together over the course of the year was very evident. You know, particularly with the inclusion of Dan Beccaro, who is filling a role that, you know, Stephen Quincy had filled and then Peter Conley had filled before that. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of variability in that offense, and it's impressive. It shows the amount of talent that's been influxed in D.C. in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I want to see I'm curious to see how Towson's stout defense holds up against Georgetown in their defense's really first major test of the season. If you're heading out there, Terry, John Stark, who does a really nice job, is the SID for Towson's lacrosse team, sends me press releases. It's a canned food drive day. If you bring a can of food for the CAA food drive, tickets are only $5 this Saturday. And it's also First Responders Appreciation Day at United Stadium. And there'll be an exhibition game between local fire and police departments following this non-conference lacrosse game.
Oh my goodness. Then I'm
That's
definitely
good stuff,
going.
Right?
I'm definitely going.
Yeah. I wish they were played at halftime. I would want to see the firefighters and the policemen go at it during halftime. That
yeah, absolutely. Can you imagine how intense that game would be if it like came down to a Braveheart?
Oh my God, that'd be great. That would be worth your $5 ticket that you pay for when you bring a can of food for the CA food drive.
Yes.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Hey, Kyle Devitt was up in Boston to see Harvard play Villanova in a thrilling game. Did a nice job covering that one. Harvard gets a one-goal victory. Villanova is going to Penn State this week. Villanova needs this one really bad.
Yeah.
Penn State's kind of Penn State's rolling. What are your thoughts on this game?
Well, so my thoughts are Villanova, I think Villanova and Harvard are both really good. So Harvard was very tough against Maryland in their scrimmage in College Park. So, you know, this is a time of year you just don't know who all is good. I think Harvard is good. I think Villanova is good. I think Penn State is good. I think that triumvirate those teams are going to be around over the course of the season. And so, you know, for me, I believe this game's in Hulubu Hall, one of the toughest places to play. We saw, you know, indoor facilities are always tough, as we saw Colgate fall to Michigan and Oosterbaan, two weekends ago. And so, you know, that right there makes me feel like the Nittany Lions have an advantage. You know, but I would say that, this is a game that you want to watch because both these teams are so different from who they were last year that being able to see it kills two birds with one stone in the sense that, like, you know, even if you haven't seen Duke this year, you probably can imagine what they look like in your head. Similarly with Denver, but with these two teams, because they have such new offensive personnel and so many guys contributing that hadn't previously, you know, it's worth checking this one out.
Yeah, for sure. That'll be, again, it's a 1 o'clock on Saturday. Probably get it streaming through Penn State's site, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And it'll be
BTN to go.
That'd be sweet. Number 12, Penn State, hosting, Villanova in a game that Villanova really needs. Terry, you got any more time?
No, that's it, man. I got to jump.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to this week as usual. And, I think there's a lot of good games to go and some good watching coming up.
Absolutely. Hey, Dan, I'm glad that we were able to make this happen. I hope that you guys enjoyed it. It was not our finest effort, if I might say so myself. Certainly mine. I'll speak for myself. But we'll do better next week, and we appreciate you checking it out. As always, we appreciate the interaction. And by always, I mean as of the last week and a half, because prior to that, we didn't have any interaction. So, yes. You know, keep that coming. T-Foy at InsideLacrosse.com, D-Flynn at InsideLacrosse.com, at Terrence Foy on Twitter, at D_Fly. On Twitter. We appreciate you listening. If you made it this far, kudos to you, and we will come back to talk about lacrosse next week.
Have a good week, guys. Inside Lacrosse Podcast.